I think that the things that you and I care about that got some stage time at WWDC today are not the things that people may be the most excited about.
Yeah, I think that actually some of the things that I want to talk about will be the headlines, but I think that the headlines will be cast as not a big deal in a lot of places. And they'll say, this is a small update relative to past years that's just focused on stability and improving everything in the background with a few new features. But I think to both of us, some of these are huge deals, the new features that they announced, and really feed into a lot of the kinds of hopes for the near future of interacting with all of our devices that we've been talking about.
Exactly. Here's how I think most people will talk about today's event. I'm sure that all the articles say iOS 12 is a performance-based update that's going to bring a lot of speed and bring some other privacy and do not disturb-y features. How I would talk about iOS 12 is Apple has finally made the operating system that I've always wanted. So there's some disparity there between the way that I think people are going to talk about these features and just how massive I feel like they are and how game-changing I feel like they are about the way that we use them every day. Like, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's a bigger deal than a feature that is a super nice feature but only gets used on a semi-regular occasion. I mean, basically every feature that was announced today that I'm in love with, I'm expecting to be touching every time that I pick up my phone from now on. And that's incredible.
I guess I'm only going to give myself credit for two, but two of the items on my list were things that I straight up got from these announcements. And none of them are features that I've heard many other people clamoring for. I think that it's a good sign that you feel like you got the operating system of your dreams. And I had this specific list of things that I wanted to see and got a few of them. I think that that's a very good sign for the direction of the platforms as far as we're concerned.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people might have had their expectations anywhere from disappointed to destroyed by what happened today. But I think for both of us, we were both kind of right in line with where Apple's actually going. And so I'm really excited for us to get hands on this software. I'm even considering, I shouldn't even say this, but I'm even considering public beta because of how much I want some of these things.
Yeah.
I haven't done that in a couple years, but we'll see. The first platform they talked about today was iOS, and I think that was pretty surprising. Other people seem to have had the same reaction to that I had, which is that's unusual, that iOS is usually the headliner and the opening acts are like the watch and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that set the tone in a good way because it was saying, like, none of the things that we're going to talk about today are going to blow your mind by themselves, but the whole package together is going to be a great series of updates. But that said, I think that what they announced for iOS 12 is pretty wonderful and also pretty radical.
Yeah.
You know, somebody leaked the phrase digital health a few days ago, and I don't think that actually ever came out of anyone's mouth, but that seems like a pretty good overview, like, descriptor for a lot of the stuff that they announced. It includes new do not disturb features, which include like going to bed and waking up stuff to prevent you from seeing notifications, dimming the display, and then like you have to tap something in order to see your notifications, which is so good. And I know that's something that we've talked about as one of the unpleasant parts of starting a day with these devices. And it's something that I avoid altogether by not even touching my phone until later. Except I have to these days for syncing podcasts, but that, we'll get to that. That won't be a problem anymore either.
No, it will not.
So the one feature is called Do Not Disturb During Bedtime, and it looks like it also looks nicer on the display so that it is kind of a better like bedside alarm clock kind of thing. The controls over the notification delivery are also more fine-grained. When you get a notification, there are going to be controls on it that you can use to turn down or off the volume of that kind of notification, which is a great shortcut to having to go into the settings app and nuke things if they misbehave. And it's also integrated with Siri for better suggestions of which notifications are important. And finally, they're going to group notifications for the first time, which I think this is one of the things that Android people make fun of, that I haven't used Android in a while, but grouping notifications by apps or threads or whatever, and being able to manage multiple notifications at a time. I think that's one of the biggest gripes about Notification Center currently, and they're finally going to solve that.
So now it's going to do a better job at trying to contextualize when to serve you those notifications, which I think is so great. Even this morning, I had a non-urgent but scary message that I saw first thing, as soon as I woke up. You know, I woke up, I looked at what time it was, and there's this thing that just immediately strikes me. And that's not a great way to wake up. In the Do Not Disturb features, there's this sort of morning note where when you look at your phone in the morning, you don't get to see notifications. Instead, the lock screen is sort of transformed into this happy good morning message with the weather and the time and a few different things. And you have to go through a few different screens before you can see any notifications that came through. And that kind of thing makes the phone feel like such a better experience. That's what I've been wanting for a long time. And I took a cue from you a while ago, dumped all notifications off of my iPad so that they didn't appear on the lock screen. And instead of looking at my phone in the mornings, I've been picking up my iPad and doing some work there where I don't get email notifications. I don't get text message notifications. I don't have any red bubbles. And because of that, I have a more seamless morning, and everything that needs to get to me is going to get to me a bit later. And now I don't have to worry about setting up some weird hack. It's just inherently part of the phone. These little features, they are important not because of necessarily what they do. Like, is it really that important that your messages are grouped? No, it's not that different. It still looks fairly similar. But it's trying to give you a different feeling. And I love that Apple is working on feelings instead of just features. Like, I think that's so great.
And it's kind of hard to tell where the line is actually between those two things for them at this point in their history.
Completely.
Like, the things that they're calling features are so advanced and so user-centric that a feature really is kind of defined by what feelings it's able to evoke. And that's such a humane way to design. A slightly stronger control over this kind of thing that they announced is a new app called Screen Time, which is going to be, I think, for me, a lot of people might find this thing annoying. I hope not. For me, it's going to be something that I bet is going to be at least as important as the activity app has been since I got a watch. The way that the activity app and the health app in general provide me with this sort of dashboard to check on myself about how I'm doing physiologically, the Screen Time app is going to provide these kind of reports about how you're using your device. And it's going to break it down across categories of apps, notifications, how often you pick it up, the device, like how often you actually pick up the device. And then there's a feature called App Limits, which lets you set a specific time limit for how long you can use an app. And it's going to warn you when you're almost out of time. And then when you're out of time, there's going to be a full screen thing that says you've used up your time in this app. And there's, of course, a button to ignore it. But I think that's going to be such a strong signal. And the way I envision using this is as a way of keeping myself honest with myself, because I don't have a problem anymore now that I've deleted all of the addictive apps that I use, except Instagram, I guess. That will be the big test. I don't have a problem I need to get under control, a specific problem with a specific way of using my phone that I need to get under control. But I do aspire to use it less and less, just socially, just so that I'm not like someone who is always on his phone. And I think that this app is going to allow me to really see objectively how good of a job I'm doing at that. There is an app for this that I have used at times called Moment, because it's a third-party app and because of the kinds of hacks it had to use and its lack of visibility into what you're really doing. It was never as good of an experience. It always was pretty annoying, and the habit never really stuck, but I think this will, because it'll just be so much more seamless. The other great thing about Screen Time, this is something that I came out of my office to tell my wife about, because we're expecting a baby and we've been thinking a lot about screens and kids and, you know, what we're going to do as far as how much technology to have around and to, you know, what kind of relationship to encourage or discourage with technology with our children. Screen Time has family parental controls and it has family management so that the adults can see kids' screen time activity reports on their own devices. And it has a feature to let you give kids set like amounts of time for the device and specific apps. There's a feature called Downtime that lets you, for example, allow the use of books, but not, you know, YouTube or something like that, which I think is so cool. What I think is really amazing about the design of this is that it isn't a binary thing. It's very, very granular about what you, it lets you decide what you think is healthy. And I don't want the rule in my house for my children to be, you get to use your iPad for 1 hour a day, because their books are going to be on an iPad and I want them to read as much as they want.
It's way too late for that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I'm very excited about the idea that I could say, you get to watch 1 hour of YouTube. That sounds like a lot, actually. 30 minutes of YouTube a day, but you can read books to your heart's content. And like that solves something that I've kind of worried about the inherent, compelling, addictive quality of the device. Like I see how young the iOS device and the touchscreen like hooks kids. And I'm so relieved that the way that Apple has figured out, even in just the first generation that we have here, to manage that compulsion of children's, like very natural compulsion to want to use these devices, will allow us to guide them towards content and ways of using it that we think are more healthy than other ways of using it.
I think that we are immediately trending towards talking about how this works for kids. And I think that we will be surprised. I don't think you'll be surprised, but I think many people will be surprised at how many times we end up using these as adults.
Oh, yeah.
I think that we are looking for a set of regulations on these things that feel unregulated and that we don't feel too great about. And I could very easily see friends asking friends to become the parent iPhone.
Oh, that's a funny idea.
And giving allowances out for apps and actually blocking it down. Because with the app limits that already exist on a phone, you can now say, I only want to spend an hour a day on Instagram. But as soon as you hit that hour, there's a button every time that you open it that says, would you like to ignore this limit?
Right.
And many people will set that, hit ignore, and then continue hitting ignore and feeling even more shame than ever. And I think that there will probably be people who ask other people to set actual locks on their phone and just give them allowances of those times and not go past it. And, you know, once you open an app, if you have hit that time limit, it just is not going to open, or it's going to give you one of these weird screens that says no. And I think I think people will actually find that quite freeing. I think that this is going to freak some social media companies out, man. I haven't really heard anything about that yet. But if I was Instagram, I would not be pleased that both Android and the iPhone have these built-in limits of how many DAUs you can actually have and how many hours you can spend in these apps. I mean, that's kind of the antithesis of why they exist.
Yeah.
But it's been coming down the pipeline for a while.
And how about the fact that they used Instagram on screen as the example of the limited app, the app that you would want a time limit for?
Yeah, I mean, and this is the funny thing about Apple, right? I actually don't remember what apps were used by Google during their conference.
Right.
But Apple has no apps that are going to require this limit. The companies that are going to be impacted by this are their competitors. So it's interesting to see a platform that can actually say, we have no skin in this game. We just want to see you be healthy, do some pretty big damage to their competitors by releasing a feature like this.
Yeah. And you remembered, which I did not, that the product branding name for the feature that you're using to manage the time for kids is allowances, which I find brilliant. I find it so ingenious. It ties it in so well with the idea of what an allowance is and makes it so much more than like the financial transaction that I think people are used to when they talk about allowances with their kids. I think you're totally right that people are going to want to use this with their actual, like adults are going to want to use this with their actual friends. And I almost hope that they start to add these kinds of features like allowances and notifications about other people's usage to the mainstream adult way of using the app. It kind of goes along with the fitness challenges that they've had in watchOS, and they've now added competitions. They've added challenges to other users where you can have like a week-long competition with somebody in exercise.
Interesting.
I kind of hope they do the same thing with this. I mean, it seems absurd, but I kind of hope they... I would love it if they did.
Yeah.
The next most important thing I would say, I guess it all falls under the heading of Siri. There were big changes to Siri. This was one of my list items, was I was hoping for an expansion of what Siri is capable of. And I don't have the same specific needs for that developers need. Developers wanted new intents for Siri. Like Siri already has certain kinds of data that you can use, like tasks, directions, ride hailing. There's like a few specific categories of app that Apple has made possible for third parties to use so that you can say, hey, name of artificial intelligence, add in OmniFocus, add a reminder to take out the trash. And that will work inside of OmniFocus. So developers are hoping, and actually they could actually very well receive these things in the, you know, next few days of sessions at WWDC, new expansions of the kinds of data that Siri can use. But for me, I just wanted more Siri in more things. And the thing that they delivered in iOS is so mind-blowing that I actually think it might be, in the long run, more significant than all this digital health stuff. So when Apple acquired the app Workflow, which was a landmark achievement in iOS development, after many years of trying to find ways to hook apps together and have them send information back and forth, Workflow achieved this incredible thing where they made a graphical interface, a sort of iOS version of the Apple application Automator, which is the first application for these platforms that turned scripting, which is a programming thing. You have to kind of be able to program in order to script inter-app communication. They turned that into a graphical application where you can just create these chains of human readable things that connect to each other, like actions. And so Workflow made this thing, and then they had a gallery on the, in, they have a gallery in their app of actions that you can take. Do you have like a good example of a kind of Workflow action? Do you use Workflow?
I'm probably not the greatest user, but simple stuff like make PDFs, other stuff like I have a workflow so that I immediately go to Spotify Discover Weekly instead of just Spotify. I have a packing list that gets sent to things automatically.
So the packing list one, I think, is a great example of the kind of thing that might blow normal people's minds, but then they realize that they want to use this and know and like can figure it out. So what you're saying is you have a button that you created using Workflow that says create packing list, and it you tap that button and it runs in the background, and then what, outputs a list of a checklist to things or something?
Yeah, it creates a project and things, and it has all the stuff that I need to pack, and I can modify it slightly in the workflow in case I need to add something else. But yeah, it works immediately.
So that's the perfect example of the kind of thing that Workflow enabled. And then Apple acquired that company, and people started to wonder immediately what was going to happen. So often when Apple, or when any big tech company acquires a third-party app like that, it gets shut down, or it gets, you know, rolled in invisible ways, or really they were just hiring the people who worked there, and it wasn't really about the actual technology that they had built so far. But they kept updating Workflow after the acquisition, and that was a really good sign. But I don't know if, I certainly wasn't expecting this soon for Apple to launch its own first-party app. And it's called Siri Shortcuts. Shortcuts is the name of the app. And this is going to be built into iOS 12. And there's going to be this gallery of these kinds of things. The best part is that it's a Siri feature. So you can say, hey, name, I'm going home now. And it will start that workflow for you. And this is the exact kind of thing. I imagined this changing my life. Like, I'm going to use my watch to start these things and not even look at a screen so much more often now, and I'm going to look at the phone so much less as a result.
This is one of those features that was better than I could have imagined, because I didn't think that any of these companies was ever going to give me control over language when talking to these robots, which is so critical. You and I had an off-air conversation about this once, but you use Siri quite a bit, right?
Yeah, for the basic things it's capable of, I do use it a lot.
Yeah, and I do not. And the reason why I do not is because I have such a hard time when I say, hey, name that we're not saying, as not to evoke a bunch of HomePods or watches or whatever. When I say that phrase, I pause for a second and I think, I know what I'm trying to say. I know that I want to have a reminder set for some meeting or ask the weather or something. But in my mind, I'm trying to think, okay, what's the actual language I have to use to get the result that I want? And that little pause of trying to figure out how I can get Siri to parse what I'm trying to say is so frustrating that I never, ever, ever use Siri just because of that. And when I do use it, I often find failure because it doesn't understand exactly what I'm trying to say. But this ability to create a shortcut that is based on my own words, my own way of talking, is incredibly powerful. Like the one example they used is saying to Siri that, like, hey, I lost my keys. And that feels great to say that. We have in the office, we recently got a Nest thermostat, and the Nest thermostat weirdly came with a free Google Home. Is that what that thing's called?
Yeah.
And so my office mate happily set up the Google Home, and then has been trying to talk to it and get it to do commands. And the weird way that he has to talk to get it to check the temperature, what is the temperature in the office space set to? Like, very specific. You can't say what's the temperature, it's going to fail. You have to be so specific about the way of talking to it. And the ability to set your own language just unlocks it for me in a really significant way. And I think I'm going to end up just using it all the time for that exact reason.
Yeah. One really powerful feature that's worth mentioning now, even though it's a new watchOS 5 feature that they added that will make this even more natural, is that they removed the requirement to say, hey, name, from the watch. So yeah. You just raise your wrist and talk to it, and it assumes that you talking, like, you know, in a speaking voice directly into your watch when it's raised is a Siri command. You know, that sounds kind of mind-blowing. Like, I'm not sure how they're going to distinguish that from any other background talking, but that is going to make it so much better, because the hey part is the place where you pause, because you know what to say to get it to start, and then you pause.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that this makes it even more natural. And yeah, you're right. Like, being able to set the text of it yourself, that's going to make it easier for people to come up with these, I think. Come up with things for it to do. You know, picking them from a gallery is one thing, but if it's something that occurs naturally that you want to happen automatically, like, you're going to be able to think of it now in much more natural terms, because you're going to say, I wish I could just say, turn on my party lights.
Yes.
And have it work exactly the way you want. And this, now you'll be able to build that.
As opposed to turn on the Philips Hue bulbs in the living room and set them to orange 70% opacity. Like, it's so robotic. And that's one of the things that I think has limited the organic growth of these assistants. It has limited voice input as a whole.
Yeah.
Is that you aren't used to doing that. It's, I think, a little easier for you to think as a computer when you're typing something. It is harder to do that when you're speaking.
Absolutely.
We're so used to speaking organically. And I think this is maybe, I hope that this is a tip of the iceberg in the way that Apple is seeing organic growth for Siri. I have never been excited for Siri. This is the first year I'm excited for Siri. This is the most exciting feature that I've seen on iOS in years. It's a thing that I'm so interested in. I've always wanted to toggle on the iPhone, and I know it's not going to happen, but I've always wanted to toggle on the iPhone. It would allow me to flip it so that when I open my iPhone, I'm actually seeing that suggestion/widget screen and not the app icon grid.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to see the app icon grid anymore. I don't care about the app icon grid. The Siri suggestions list of apps is like 100% of the time exactly correct, and it knows exactly what I want to do.
Mm.
And the widgets can almost always do exactly what I want to do, especially with workflows built on top of it. And if you're telling me now that it's going to basically auto create workflows and call them shortcuts and know that I'm running late to a thing and just say, hey, I'm going to text somebody for you. I mean, the only thing that it can do from here is just do it itself and not ask me to do it anymore, which I don't even know if I'd want that. So I think that we've reached a good pinnacle here for what I want technology to be and how I want it to get out of my way and let me just do stuff, which is incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And maybe one last thing that it occurs to me that we haven't said yet is that you don't have to use your voice to trigger these. In exactly the same way as workflow, you will have this library of shortcuts that appear as these really nice looking large buttons with icons and colors of your choice. And those will also presumably, just like workflow, appear in the today widget for the app. There may even be the same concept that workflow has of sharing extensions for these, which they didn't demonstrate that I can recall, and maybe they're not there yet, but these things will present themselves to you where you need them, and you don't have to remember to say the thing depending on what it is. Like, there are all kinds of ways to set these off. And yeah, you're right, it's a pinnacle of like the ability to just concentrate on what you want the device to do and not have to figure out the path from A to B to C to D to get it done, at least after the first time when you build this shortcut. Just the rest of the iOS features, there's kind of two sections. The first section we can blow through, which is just they've updated some of the stock apps in ways that are minor, but, you know, look great. The Books app, formerly known as iBooks, has now been renamed Apple Books. Its typography is a lot better, and the menus are a lot better. And there are new ways to browse new titles.
It got a little of its three-dimensionness back, three-dimensionality.
Yeah, Yeah, it did. The books have shadows, especially in the Reading Now section.
Ooh.
I was an iBooks, exclusively iBooks user for a long time for my eBooks before I decided I needed a non-backlit screen and had to get a Kindle. But I still maintain my library of eBooks in iBooks, and I really would prefer to use Apple for this if, you know, I could. And when I have an OLED device, I will find it easier on the eyes and go back. But one of the things I had to do for myself was create a collection or shelf or whatever they're called Currently Reading, because there was no easy way to find the thing I'm reading now in the library. And now they have a big full width Reading Now with a nice preview of the book. Apple News got more discovery features for finding new sections and favorites, an easier way. There were favorites in the app before, but now there's an easier tab and better design for you to jump straight to your favorite sources to read those alone instead of just looking at the algorithmic feed, which is mostly what I do anyway. I find Apple News' algorithm to be amazing. And on the iPad, it has a sidebar for easier navigation. And that's about it, except that also they updated the Stocks app. Big deal, but they also are bringing Apple News stories, business stories into the Stocks app. And I think that might foretell something kind of interesting about how news data is going to be used around the Apple ecosystem. And you know, maybe there are more integrations with apps coming for Apple News. For example, like I can imagine wanting to use the Washington Post app. I'm a digital subscriber to the Washington Post. I actually have to jump back and forth between Washington Post and Apple News because I want to see everything that's in Washington Post, not just the ones that are in Apple News, but I want Apple News to get my data about which stories I liked. So I have to open stories from the Washington Post app in Apple News. And I would really like it if the Apple News integration, like that they have in the Stocks app, was made available to iOS developers in the news world so that they could actually connect news to their app. But that's not here yet, but there's an interesting preview. There was an update to Voice Memos also. That's the other stock app that I think that got an interesting update. It's on the iPad for the first time, and it has its own iCloud Drive folder, which is great because Voice Memos disappeared into a little hole in Voice Memos, and you'd have to send them somewhere if you wanted them to sync. So now I'm glad that's dealt with. And the other category of stuff that they really changed in iOS, it maybe all falls under the heading of social features. And the big one is FaceTime. FaceTime got group calling for the first time, and it's 32 people is the maximum.
It seems like so many people.
It's so many. But then if you think about it, like this is just gonna be the way that people have meetings in Apple shops. You know, like we're all at Burning Man, we all have Macs from the company, so why wouldn't we use FaceTime as our way of having meetings? And they've done new design, very Apple-y design. It does not resemble any of the Google or Skype ways of highlighting who's talking. There's these floating square tiles, and the person who's talking sort of gradually floats to the front. It's very nice. And I think that we may find that this group FaceTime feature is a game changer for podcasters. We already use FaceTime as our call mechanism for while we're podcasting, and I think it would be pretty easy to FaceTime in a third person and split off the audio and have guests on the show with much less fiddling around than before.
Yeah.
The other thing about FaceTime that's cool is that means that you can participate in a group call on Apple Watch, which was not possible before. To have a high quality FaceTime audio call, or even probably video, I'm not sure what would happen if somebody tried to add you in and you picked up on your watch and were maybe just audio, you know, maybe that will be possible. Now we'll have to see whether you can do like audio only, like you can on lots of group calling apps. Extending the ability to have conference calling to the watch is pretty cool. And the other social features are all kind of emoji related or animoji related, which is something that I cannot enjoy because I do not have an iPhone 10. But the big change that they made is a new Apple creation called Memoji, which lets you build yourself in animoji style and use that all over the place. They added animoji to a lot of different places, including FaceTime and the camera app and all these things. And now you can build it with tons and tons and tons of customizability options. You can build yourself, and you can then have, just like people, what's that app, Bitmoji, that people use all the time?
Yep.
It's like horrible cartoon stickers. Now you can have a 3D animated moving version of your face, which at the present time, I don't see myself, like if I had an emoji right now, I don't think I would send very many foxes to people, but I definitely am going to waste a lot of time at one point making myself an Memoji, and then how am I not going to use it once I know it's there?
Well, and the thing about it is that I feel like this was an interesting example of Apple using a technology that they had, which is this crazy Kinect-like depth-sensing front camera to make these Animoji. And they made it as a what seemed to be a pretty gimmicky feature. I never assumed that I was going to start getting more Animoji texts than I was getting normal texts. And I kind of thought that it might be one of those weird Apple features that was very interesting and very flashy, and then in like a year or two kind of dropped off the face of the earth. And with everything they added to it, it seemed like they've really, really looked at how people were using Animoji and how they could make people use them more. And I think it was extremely smart. Mm-hmm. One of the things that kind of tipped me off to that immediately was they made a joke about it that they had developed all this new technology so that you could now sense your tongue.
Yeah.
And these Animoji can now stick out their tongue. But I think that it is probably the case that they observed how many people were trying to stick out their tongue on an Animoji, not being able to do so and feeling a little awkward.
Yeah.
And they just went ahead and added that feature. And then, okay, to send an Animoji, you have to open up iMessage, you have to record it, you have to send it. It doesn't feel very live. But now you can superimpose the Animoji onto your face, and you can send a video of your human body with your Animoji face on top of it. And not only can you send that in an iMessage, but you can put it on top of yourself in a FaceTime call. So now the use cases for these Animoji are way, way higher, and they're much more in line with a Snapchat filter than they are with an iMessage sticker. And then on top of all of that, they have superseded everything that they could have possibly done beforehand and literally just let you make yourself. And, you know, Samsung recently revealed something similar to this, and their equivalent of the Memoji looks real, real bad. And I had a Nintendo Wii, and the Nintendo Wii lets you make a Mii. And the Miis were cute, but they were not extremely good. And in fact, it was pretty hilarious how much work you could put into trying to make your friend and how poorly it could come off. There was an image behind Craig when he was announcing this that just had a few dozen of these Memoji faces on there, and they're incredible. Like, they're really good.
Yeah.
Like, they look like people. They don't look like caricatures of people. They look like people.
In the call, the FaceTime demo, when he had the whole FaceTime team call in,
yeah,
did you see Tim Cook like 30 seconds before he started talking? Because I totally did too. I was like, oh, look, cartoon Tim Cook is there. Like, is that actually Tim Cook? You know, because it could have been somebody else who made a Tim Cook Memoji just to have fun, and it was totally Tim Cook on the call live from backstage,
right?
And like and that was so amazing because the feature is very well suited to the kind of dad humor that Apple people have, but like it was so obviously Tim Cook, and you know, it just it worked so seamlessly, so naturally, even though the moment was kind of scripted. You know, this cartoon version of the CEO showed up at this proud team's moment of glory to congratulate them, and it just came off very genuine.
Yeah.
Apple also used this as an opportunity to showcase wild diversity of human beings, and I thought that was very nice. You know, like and I'm not just talking about skin color and garments, though of course there was plenty of diversity in that, but like if you look at the grids of Memoji that they've created, there it's young people and old people, there's gender all across the spectrum, people have crazy sunglasses, and then like some people are pink or green.
Mm-hmm.
It's gonna let people express themselves however they want, and I think it's a great feature.
Yeah, I was unexpectedly blown away by how good that was.
Yeah, me too, and it made me reconsider my timeline for getting a new phone, of course.
Yes.
But we'll wait till November for that. There are just a couple other things in the sort of iOS world. The one that seems most connected to the Memoji stuff we were just talking about is the new augmented reality features, ARKit features. ARKit 2 is what they're calling it. It's a whole new set of AR programming tools. And, you know, you can see in a feature like Memoji just how good Apple is getting at capturing real world and like superimposing digital 3D information onto real world things. And the on-stage demo of the new ARKit features was a Lego game. So it wasn't super compelling to me as a user, but what it demonstrated was the new ability for multiple devices to see the same 3D object in the same place, in the real, you know, like floating in the real world, persistent AR as they called it. So that there's, you can leave virtual objects in the real world and come back to them, which is so cool. And one of the fundamental pieces that they have created to enable this is a new file type, which to me is just the most Apple-y thing ever. You know, it's not, this new AR stuff that they're building is not just going to be some cloud service where you all log into something and the mothership is streaming all of these objects to you. You're now going to be able to send objects to one another and then pop them into the world and look at them, or build them on a website and download them and see them and share them. And Adobe came up on stage for a moment and announced that they're going to build support for this AR object file type into their creative suite, so that you, and with a what you see is what you get editor, so that you're going to be able to create 3D objects using the graphics tools, the state-of-the-art graphics tools available to anyone, and drop them into the world, and then other people are going to be able to see them. And that's just getting awfully close to the screenless world that we keep talking about.
Yeah.
Although, of course, you still have to hold up large glass rectangles in front of your face to see them.
For now.
For now, exactly.
This is one of those examples of a feature that is, to me, so clearly iterative, because it's not anything that I care about right now. But I feel like it's laying the groundwork for something that I'm going to care about quite deeply in a few years, especially when the ability for it to be on a different platform changes. And the fact that they're working so hard to allow developers to create stuff with such seamlessness and make it so native to Apple's platform, I think is a big deal, and says some good things about the kind of augmented reality devices that Apple could be cooking up for the future.
Yep, they did announce one application that they are shipping with iOS that I forgot to mention, which I think I would use immediately, which is called Measure. And I'm sure that there are other apps that do this already, third-party apps, but having one built into the phone is pretty awesome. And really what it is you hold your phone up and point it at an object, and you are able to measure its actual physical dimensions on screen, so that if you need to buy a picture frame, you can aim your phone at the picture and it will measure the dimensions of it. And that's just, I would use that all the time. The idea that Apple is making these kinds of AR features more and more primitive, more and more fundamental to the software, is just really exciting when you think about where that's going to get us to 5-10 years from now.
Yeah.
It's once those things are basic to the reality that we live in. So the one more, I guess this counts as an iOS feature, that we should probably mention just because of one interesting thing about it, is that CarPlay added support for third-party navigation apps, which I kind of couldn't believe. I kind of couldn't believe that they showed Waze, Google Maps, and whatever that Chinese one is on screen. And people applauded. They like opened themselves up to this moment where people would be excited to not use an Apple service. And Google Maps is right there on the screen as one of the features of iOS and in your car. And I have never owned a CarPlay car, but I did rent one time, and it was so awesome. And I just, the ability to have maps up on the dashboard like that, you know, with all of my favorites and all my, you know, I can, and my event, like hotel directions already there. It was so great. And I think people are pretty stoked that you're going to be able to use Google Maps that way now. And you might say, I mean, maybe my first reaction was, whoa, they are backing off the race to compete with Google Maps here by showing this. It's an admission of defeat. But you could really argue it's the opposite. It's a display of confidence that Apple Maps is good enough that they don't have to be afraid of people using alternatives.
Hmm.
Okay, time to move to Apple Watch. Everybody knows this is my favorite thing in the ecosystem, and I am pretty thrilled with what Apple announced for watchOS 5. One thing they did not announce, which is now revealed, is that watchOS 5 will not be supported on the Series 0 watch, which means that I will be staying put with my original watch, which I use for sleep, and we'll see how much longer I can even use the thing at all. It sounds like a pretty clear signal that the end is near for that app, for that watch. And you know what sucks about that is what happens to the people who spent $15,000 or $17,000 on a solid gold Series Zero watch now?
Hey, man, they've had it for a little while. They got to use it. It had its day in the sun.
I guess that's true. And now maybe they'll all go in museums or something like that. So anyway, watchOS 5, you know, of course, there are a lot of new fitness features. Some of them, we have already corresponded about how grateful we are for them, like the auto detection that you are not working out anymore. You don't have to stop your workout manually. It also has detection that you are working out, but I find it much easier to remember to start a workout than to stop one. Do you agree with that?
Yes, definitely.
So that's a big one. Then the other thing they added as a fitness feature was a competition mode. They already had activity sharing, so you got notifications. I get notifications every day when Drew is finished working out.
Wait, do you really?
Yeah, I do. I turned them off for a while, but then when other people I knew started getting watches and requesting me, I turned them all back on. So now I get them.
Okay. All right.
And it hasn't driven me crazy again yet, so I haven't turned it back off.
Okay.
And so you get those when people have finished workout, you get them when they close their rings, and you get them when they achieve things and get badges and stuff. But now there's a challenge. There's an activity competition where you can send people 7-day competitions and you get points for the closing the red ring. So every percentage point you get for your activity goal is a point. And it has tightly integrated shortcuts for talking smack and for congratulating them also.
Of course, of course.
I will never, ever, ever, ever use this, but I am sure that some people are going to use it too much. Then the other big ones I would say are new workout types. The two most significant I would say are yoga and hiking. The difference between these workout types is starting to become clear to me, like why there are different types, because the watch wants to be as conservative as possible about what sensors it's running and how much battery it's using. That's why it's conservative about which sensors it's running. So a workout type like outdoor walk, for example, which is what I use when I'm hiking, until watchOS 5 comes out, does not necessarily take into account elevation change. But when you're hiking, you might be climbing and descending, 1,000 feet or more. And that really does change the amount of exercise you're getting. And so now there's a hiking workout type that will better measure that. I'm pretty stoked about that. I'm sure that yoga people are thrilled about the yoga one. And it's all about just increasing accuracy about the measurements. That's what Kevin Lynch came out talking about, was the way that they're just dead set on making Apple Watch as accurate as possible for fitness measurements. There's more like advanced features for real serious fitness people and, you know, new metrics and new ways of integrating with workout equipment and all that stuff. But these are what I would say are the basic features.
I was not surprised to see that Apple led with the activity features, because I still think that this is the thing that people are buying the watch for. It feels sort of like a Trojan horse to me.
Yes.
That this is what people see as, oh, this is a really good feature, because it is a good feature. I was in myself incredibly motivated by filling the three rings. And of course, Lynch himself said that from the stage, that people always tell him how important those rings are to their health. And I think that's great. None of the features that they added today are features that I'm going to be using. But the fact that they're constantly developing out activity is the exact right thing to do, I think, for Apple, because it's allowing them to get more and more people to engage in this, especially with the activity sharing stuff. Like you, I don't believe I'll be sending challenges to all of my bros, but it is a good thing, and people will probably encourage their friends to get Apple Watches for that specific feature, and then those people might be surprised at how much they're using the Apple Watch for a whole lot of different things beyond just working out.
Yes, and so to that end, there are some pretty exciting features that are not fitness related that are coming to watchOS 5. The big one, the one that was on my list, is podcasts for the Apple Watch. And that is the thing I've wanted the most all year long. The thing I mentioned earlier in the show about why I have to look at my phone in the morning is because that's how I know what podcasts have come out. Mm. And then I have to do this terrible dance where I turn on airplane mode on my phone so that the watch disconnects from the phone and connects to the Wi-Fi. Then I launch Outcasts, a third-party app for playing podcasts on the watch. That almost works fine. And I then find the podcast and download it over Wi-Fi, and then I can go for my morning exercise with the podcast on my watch without the phone. And then, of course, the problem is that playback does not sync with the podcast app. So if I don't finish the podcast that I'm listening to, I have to come back and manually scrub the podcast to the point that I got to on my watch in order to keep listening. And I'm pretty tired of this dance. I'm pretty blown away by the fact that I can go leave my house with a podcast playing without any wires and without a phone. But this friction is a lot, and it's every day. And as I said, it's not just that there's friction in getting the podcast on the watch. It's that I have to look at my phone in order to do that. And I don't want to look at my phone until I'm ready to see the stuff that's going on that day. And that time in the morning that I'm working out and meditating and all the stuff, which I use my watch heavily for, that's pre-phone time for me.
Yeah.
So now podcast is coming to the watch. I need to see it in order to know if it's completely everything that I asked for, or if it's just a decent substitute for what I really want. But what I mean is, does the thing download the podcasts to the device, or is it just going to stream them? If it's going to download them, they need to change the way that watchOS connects to the internet. And they really should change this. And it's possible that we'll find out from later WWDC sessions this week whether they did change this. There is absolutely no reason that the watch should privilege Bluetooth when it is sitting on a charger. It should connect to Wi-Fi instead of connecting to the phone via Bluetooth when it's sitting on the charger.
Interesting.
Because it doesn't matter how much battery it uses, right?
Yeah.
And so when I do this thing in the morning, when I turn my phone on airplane mode, the watch gets full strength, full speed Wi-Fi from my router. I'm able to download a 2-hour podcast in a few seconds. But if it's connected to the phone, it's basically impossible, because it takes so long that the watch goes to sleep and it kills the app. You know, like, it's not possible. So my hope is that in watchOS 5, and if not then please God next year, while the watch is charging, it will connect to Wi-Fi, and then the podcast app will automatically download podcasts like it does on the phone.
Mm.
That's my hope. There is podcast playback on the watch. If I have to stream it over cellular, I will. That is going to change my whole morning every day. Would you use that?
Oh, yeah.
Because if it does download, I bet it does download, because what are people without LTE watches going to do if it doesn't download?
I think that there is now a very good chance for me to be able to do a lot without my phone, even in an example like the gym. I mean, it'd be great to just start a workout and have a podcast on my watch and put my phone down, because it's not awesome to have a big phone in your pocket while you're doing stuff at the gym. And yeah, no, I think this is going to be really, really good. This is the first time that I felt the itch to have a cell service Apple Watch, which is a good thing, because I think that I am the demographic for that. And the fact that I haven't really wanted one is something that Apple should be working on. And here they go, working on it pretty hard.
Yep. So there's another reason that you might want one, which is the other new app that they announced, which is called Walkie Talkie, which I am so stoked for.
Right.
It is exactly what it sounds like. It is a push to talk for connecting to other people, watch to watch. It's very interesting that there is no iPhone connection to this. And I can't figure out why yet, but I bet it's because it doesn't, because which device would it go to? You know, if you were using both. So they wanted to keep it simple. But I think it works so well as a watch only app. And it's also something that will sell watches, because people will want to use this. It has a buddy list system like Find My Friends does. So you explicitly connect, you request to connect with somebody. And if you accept, then you're both available to each other at push to talk on the watch whenever you want. And so this is not like the voice messages thing that people are seemingly starting to use, where you can send a little voice snippet to somebody via messages. This is like a radio. So the immediate use case I thought of was driving in a convoy. I do a lot of that in my day job, at least certain parts of the year. There are a lot of people in multiple vehicles doing stuff at Burning Man or on the way to Burning Man. And this is the perfect way to say to somebody, turn off at the next exit, I gotta pee. And so that's the use case I thought of first. The fact that it's two-handed, that you have to touch a screen button in order to communicate, might prove a little awkward. Like, you know, wouldn't it be cool if it took over the side button or something like that? But I mean, this looks great. I'm going to use this all the time with people who have watches. Not that very many people who I need to use walkie-talkies with have watches yet.
I'm curious to know if this is one of those features that is going to be never heard from again. I always have that worry about Apple communication features.
Yeah.
That they get this big splashy WWDC keynote and then no one really uses it, and then it languishes until 3 or 4 operating systems down the line it's removed completely or totally downplayed. I would like to see this pushed more into the forefront, because I think one of the things that the Apple Watch can do is change the way that we communicate. Because I do not think that texting is the best form of communication between humans. I think that talking is much, much better. And I think that anything that we can do to bring talking back is good. And this is one of those things that takes away the cumbersome nature of phone calls and makes it more convenient. I will be curious to see if this gets developed out or not. And I'll also be curious to see if this ever ends up coming to the phone in some way, sort of like those voice snippets or whatever are a feature of iMessage. But regardless, I think it's really neat, and I hope that I find some people to walkie-talkie with.
Yep. Quick real-time follow-up on podcast syncing for offline playback. I am reading on Mac Rumors, so it's their fault if I'm wrong, that not only will podcasts sync automatically for offline playback, but music, even from third-party apps, and audiobooks also will sync to the watch for offline playback. They also announced that books was coming to CarPlay, which is, I'm sure, something that people are going to love.
Audiobooks.
Yeah. The other big thing for watchOS is that the Siri face is going to have more shortcuts and suggestions. I presume that includes shortcuts you create from the Siri shortcuts thing. So like if you usually run a like time to go home shortcut to do all that stuff, like send text to your partner and start directions and stuff, I assume that will pop up in the feed of the Siri face, which of course I use every day because it's the best watch face. And they said that third-party apps are going to get to show up here as well. So now I'm imagining OmniFocus tasks showing up in there, and I'm just over the moon. I can't wait.
These are all features that are going to make the stuff that we use every day so much better. And the Siri face is indeed the best Apple Watch face, and I'm glad to see that third parties are finally going to get a crack at being in there.
Yeah. And then the one other thing they announced for watchOS is student ID cards for specific universities that are supporting it, which is, you know, to pay for food and laundry and get into buildings and stuff using your watch. That doesn't sound like a big deal to most of us, except that this is just the beginning of this being the default way to do all of this. Next year, I presume that they're going to start announcing public transit systems that are accepting Apple Watch connections as ways of getting in and paying, or maybe even this year if third parties can build into it. That's a future that we've talked about as well, where you don't have to carry that kind of stuff around with you and on plastic cards
or on your freaking phone even.
Or on your phone.
I mean, yeah, it's now even more convenient. It's just on your wrist and things are going to work with it immediately. I do think that you're right that this is actually a big feature that's being brought to the world in a very small way, because I could see this being used for hotels, for Airbnbs, for everything. And the more people that have these and the more integrations they have, the more successful it'll be.
So that's the watch. This was not the WWDC where Apple announced the new Apple TV with all Apple's new first party video content stuff on it.
No.
That has not happened yet. And so all of the updates to the TV, Apple TV, are incremental. And so I continue in my complete limbo about whether or not to get a tvOS Apple TV or just keep my old one.
Your problem was not solved today.
My problem was not solved. Probably very few people's problems with TV were solved today. Oh, one thing we forgot to say about iOS, a really remarkable thing, is that it's going to support every single device that was supported by iOS 11. And that is such a big deal, because since it's part of this idea of slowing down and focusing on stability and improving the internals, and I think that it's going to be so great for users that iOS continues to support everyone who got the last iOS update is going to still be able to get the next one.
Yeah.
With macOS 10.14, that is not the case. This one is really pushing things forward behind the scenes and comes with a lot of striking visual differences to go along with that. The big one is dark mode, which was the only leak of anything that happened in this keynote. And that's a system-wide dark mode that in the last macOS update, they made a dark dock and menu bar, which I think they did because it's just a little easier on the eyes. And certain apps like Logic Pro Studio, Work Studio apps are largely, the UI is dark colored because they're used in studios. So Apple last year just kind of made the dock and the menu bar a little more friendly to those environments. But now there's going to be a dark mode for everything, for apps and for the whole UI, which is great, including Xcode, apparently. And there's an API so that you can implement it in your own app. They also added dynamic desktop wallpapers, which is something that has been on iOS, but it doesn't really mean the same thing. That's kind of a cool idea to me, having a moving, living background on my Mac that will make it feel a lot more futuristic. And with a much bigger, more beautiful screen, it's going to really just feel cool to have, you know, moving clouds or whatever it is. As far as how the Mac actually works, the Finder, the biggest change is the addition of Stacks, which you mentioned a third-party app called Hazel that I've never used that seems to do more or less the same thing. But, you know, a lot of people have problems with clutter on their desktop. Maybe it would not surprise you or the listeners to know that I do not have that problem. My desktop is immaculate, but I do use it all day long as a way of kind of organizing the files I'm actively working on. And the desktop Stacks feature lets you put icons in piles based on file type. And you can also customize it to sort it however you want with different attributes, including date and using the Finder tags, which still don't really have enough ways of sticking. I use a few tags in the Finder, which I find especially useful because they're available in the Files app on iOS too. So if I have a file in iCloud Drive, which I do use the desktop and documents folder syncing for iCloud Drive, so anything on my desktop is available on any device. I also have a couple of tags. The one I use the most is a yellow tag called In Use, which lets me highlight a file that I need access to a lot everywhere. And so that's one of the ways that you can sort stuff on the desktop as well. So if you do keep a lot of things under desktop, this feature will be huge. Then the rest is just kind of new views of information that we already had. There's a new gallery view for previewing files and lots of stuff like that. Sidebars with more metadata. Quick view, the thing where you tap the space bar and pull up a preview of a file, has markup now, which is available in Mail and also in a lot of places on iOS where you can kind of draw and make some minor edits to images and PDFs and stuff. You can even trim video and audio clips, and that's without an app. That's something that the OS does. And then a lot of iOS stuff came to the Mac, and they talked about why. News, Stocks, Voice Memo, and Home, which is a big one because the HomeKit stuff was not available on the Mac before, are all coming to the Mac. And they were built more easily than Mac apps were built in the past because Apple is making it increasingly easy to move iOS, to use iOS frameworks on macOS. And at the end of the presentation, they telegraphed that that kind of stuff is going to become increasingly available to developers for their own apps. So there have been a lot of rumors about merging iOS and Mac or bringing iOS apps to the Mac in a big, blunt, obvious way. And it sounds like, you know, the people who understand Apple better could have predicted what's actually happening, which is they're just gradually making it possible to share more and more code between the two platforms.
Right.
And they're developing that ability by porting over the apps that they have built for iOS first that obviously need Mac companions like News and Home. And News in particular is really exciting to me because I'm a big Apple News user, and not having the ability to read my saved stories on my Mac when I'm at my desktop has been bothering me. So that's a big one. And one other very important long overdue thing that has come to the Mac from iOS is the App Store redesign. And it's not even really the same redesign. It has the same features with the editorial content that they've added to iOS, with stories about new apps and these rich previews of them and interviews with developers and stuff like that. And But it looks like it's going to be even more expansive of a way to browse because it's got this new design. This seems to be a design convention now for Mac apps that Apple's putting a sidebar in for navigation. That's what the new how the news app works, and that's how this new App Store app works. There are categories like create, work, and play for browsing apps, and there's more categories too if you drill down another level. And updates is just one of those tabs in the sidebar, and it's going to be way, way, way easier and better to find apps for what you need to do on the Mac. And it sounds like the assurances that Apple needed to give to big Mac developers that they should invest in the App Store platform and not just keep going it alone and you know having downloads from their own websites. So a lot of big Mac apps have left the App Store after not getting the kind of features that they need, and the App Store app being so bad that people just weren't discovering their app. So it was better. It wasn't worth the 30% cut. And for a lot of Mac developers, they some high profile ones, they have pulled out of the App Store and started to just go back to selling their own apps for download, because you can still do that on a Mac, and you can't do it on iOS at all, and never could. So the Mac App Store wasn't working, and so Apple needed to provide some assurances to app developers that they were going to support the Mac App Store going forward, because it had languished for many, many years without getting any changes. And they seem to have done it because they announced a bunch of high profile, big corporate and like legendary indie Mac apps coming back to the Mac App Store, including Transmit from Panic, their FTP app, and BB Edit, the barebone software text editor, which is my hardcore text editor. It's one of the oldest and most storied text editors on the Mac. And the fact that that kind of stuff is coming back to the Mac App Store is a very good sign for indie developers. But then also they mentioned that Microsoft Office apps are going to be sold through the App Store.
And Adobe Lightroom.
And so that's a big signal that many companies have committed lots of resources to going back to the Mac App Store, which means that Apple is following through on the things that developers need from it in order to use it.
Panic is actually a really interesting example, because I don't know if you saw this yet or not, but they are apparently going to be offering Transmit as a subscription app in the Mac App Store, and then allowing you to purchase it outright on their own website.
Oh, interesting.
So they're kind of figuring out this interesting way of utilizing a store like the Mac App Store. If you just want it for a short period of time, or you like subscriptions, you can go ahead and get it from the App Store. If you just want to have it the old school way, you can just go and buy it, you know, like you always would from Panic themselves. And one of the things that the subscription will allow them to do is give a free trial away, which is another interesting example of kind of figuring out how the Mac App Store is going to work for some of these devs.
Yep, that's very cool. That's exactly what developers need, is just more options for finding the right business model that supports the way their application works and the way that their users relate to their application. And this it seems to be coming to the Mac App Store in force in this update.
Right.
The kind of last salvo of the Mac section was new Safari changes, which as usual are basically full frontal assaults on Google and Facebook and other creepy internet companies. Even more ways of preventing tracking in the browser. The specific one that came this time was through like and share buttons and comment widgets and things like that, which are one of the most pernicious and pervasive ways of tracking people across the internet. You know, if you're logged in to Facebook, if you're not, I'm not even sure. Any website that has a Facebook like button is basically a cooperator with the surveillance state of Facebook. And Apple is now adding ways of confusing and blocking those. And they're even adding pop-ups for if you click on them to say, you know, this is going to track you, right? And
right.
I'm hoping this just freezes the use of on-page social buttons just dead permanently, because everybody's going to think of Cambridge Analytica as soon as that happens. They're also simplifying the system information that Safari provides when people are browsing the web, because one of the ways that advertisers track people around the web is by the specific configuration of their device. So, you know, if like a 2016 MacBook Pro running this version of the Mac and this version of Chrome or whatever it is going between two different websites, the odds are much higher that it's the same person. And so Apple is now going to simplify that information so that it's harder to track people that way. They also are improving security in certain ways by having better auto creation and autofill of strong passwords when you create accounts. And it's also going to flag reused passwords in the password manager so that you can remember to never use the same password in two different places. Oh, we forgot the photos features, both on the Mac and on iOS. They are improving the machine learning features of photos so that now not only does it suggest photo collections to you, like memories is what one of the big features now, where it's kind of a Facebook-like feature where it reminds you of something that happened on this date 3 years ago or whatever, and it shows you those photos automatically selected. Now it's going to suggest shared photo collections. So if you and people and other friends of yours are out and you take pictures of them and save them to your iCloud photo library, it will suggest that you share a shared iCloud photo album with them. And if they took pictures, it will also suggest it so that you can just take your pictures and then later photos will encourage you to all upload them to the same place, which is so handy and so a Facebook use case and makes it so unnecessary to use Facebook for that kind of thing.
Right.
At least when you're with Apple people.
I really dig the fact that they are basically suggesting that you do all of the things and putting them right there natively in photos. And I think people will do it because of that, as opposed to having some weird feed that no one ever checks and no one ever adds anything to. This one has a good chance of working well.
Yep. I mentioned to you when this was announced on stage that I have been using iCloud photo library and photo sharing surprisingly often with friends. There's a friend, an old friend of mine who had a baby recently, and the first photos of that baby were sent to a bunch of us in a group iMessage thread, which was Apple-centric enough. But he then mentioned that there is a shared iCloud photo library that he and that all the family members and stuff are on, and he invited us to join. Everyone in this chat thread dropped their Apple ID into the thread and we were all added to the shared photo album. And now photos are coming up every few days and we're all liking them and we see the likes and we see who liked them. And this is all using Apple services. It's so crazy to think about, but this is absolutely something that only could have been a Facebook use. This could only have been done by us on Facebook a few years ago, and now it's something we're just using Apple's native features for.
I think that this is an example of the ways that Apple is continuing to diverge from the other people that are in the same spaces as them, and also finding ways to bring the good features that those companies get from bad behavior. You don't have to create a perfect, incredible database of everyone's faces to tell you when you took a picture with Kimberly and immediately prompt you to take the photo and bring it Kimberly's way. You don't have to do these creepy things to get those good features baked into an operating system.
Definitely. And I think people have been skeptical of Apple's ability to deliver this, but I think it's pretty clear that they're really getting there. And there was one last thing that they announced as sort of the future looking thing. And I bet this is the subject of a lot of workshops this week at the conference, the outgrowth of this phenomenon, which is that they have a whole new suite of machine learning services, Core ML2, which is just a new bunch of libraries for using this exact kind of privacy-aware machine learning on local data sets, which is what Apple's doing, instead of just crunching it all on a giant surveillance database. They're looking at it internally to your hardware and your data. These libraries are being made available in enormous diversity to developers so that people building for Apple's platforms can use the same exact capabilities for doing machine learning on these huge sets of data in their own apps. Mm. This is going to be the next stage of the platform wars, I think. All OS providers in the world are going to need to compete on this kind of thing, because wherever you can build the most intelligent machine learning applications is where they're going to get built. And the Google model is clear. They, have announced all kinds of machine learning stuff. At the latest Google I.O., they announced an ML kit, which is the same kind of thing. And it's for Android and iOS, their machine learning libraries.
Mm.
So, you know, this is a new side of competition, is that these companies want to compete on who can make the best machine learning. And Google wants you to use their libraries to build on iOS because they believe that their machine learning AI stuff is superior, and Apple is competing with them. And of course, it seems unlikely to me that building in core ML is going to let you make Android apps.
No.
But that's not what Apple's interested in. And it's really cool that the level of competition for the platforms has reached this level of you know, scientific advancement. But it's so clear that Apple has proven that it's possible to provide these kinds of software capabilities in privacy-aware, user-centric ways instead of just doing it by giant surveillance and collecting data from everyone in order to study it.
Yeah, absolutely. This has been an interesting WWDC because I watched the keynote from my house, but I will actually be joining in on the fun right after I record this and visiting WWDC for the rest of this. Come find me if you are also in the San Jose area.
And if internet friends, listeners come and find you, what will you have for them?
If they find me, they do get a good internet friend sticker that looks incredible. I don't know what our little computer guy is named, but whatever his name is, he's adorable. And you can come and get one off of me. It's pretty amazing.
We do need a name for him.
Yeah.
So maybe this is a time to say, if you have a name for our mascot, the smiling computer, hit us up.
Yeah.
We can be reached on the soon-to-be-defunct service known as Twitter, at _netfriends. We can be released, we can be reached on the who-knows-what's-going-to-happen-to-it indie web version known as micro.blog at micro.blog/internetfriends or at internetfriends. And we can be reached by email at hi@internetfriends.show. And we really would love to hear from you all out there. We know you're out there. We can see visible evidence that you are out there listening to the show. We really would like to hear from you and hear how you keep in touch with your internet friends, and what your questions about internet friendship are, and what topics are interesting to you, because we want to consider you internet friends of ours as well.
Absolutely.
So please reach out by one of those means. And if you're a WWDC, go get a sticker from Drew so that you can put it up like a bat signal and find more internet friends out in the world.
This was a good one, John. I'm excited for the fall. And I think that one of the real tests to see how enticing these features are is to figure out how long it's going to take before the betas are on our phones. So I guess we'll give a little update next time we talk.
Yep. So start your clocks, because we're going to see how long it takes before we cave and put iOS 12 on everything.